Listen. That's how I feel right now. If you listened to last week's rerun episode, or if you follow us on Instagram, you know that we experienced countless audio and technical issues with this week's episode. The long of the short of it is that the first time, the original time that we recorded it together, my microphone was not plugged in correctly, so my audio was completely garbled. When we realized this, as Leah was doing the editing, I said, oh my god, I'm going to not be stressed about this. I'm just going to re-record the episode. Ha ha ha. I did re-record it and sent it over to Leah, trusting that my re-recorded audio was excellent. And it would appear that that audio was also garbled. The real MVP here is Leah, who has edited and re-edited this episode multiple times with poor audio on my end. What you can expect from this episode. We have done our very, very best with the editing to make it as good as it can be. However, there are still a couple moments where my audio is just not the best. There are a couple of moments where I re-recorded lines with better audio. So you can kind of tell, like, ooh, that's a different voice that pops in from time to time. But overall, we have done the very best that we can with this episode. This was such an amazing episode to research and record. I learned so, so much. And despite the audio issues, I really hope you enjoy this episode and that you learn a lot too. Thank you for all your support, and we will be back next week with a better audio episode. Thanks.
This episode of Hashtag History was recorded in November of 2023. Some personal updates and cultural references may be out of date, but the history hasn't changed. Enjoy.
This is Hashtag History, episode 135. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this week we are going to be looking at a very interesting event in history that resulted in a common phrase or psychological term that most of us are familiar with today, Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
We all generally know what the psychological condition of Stockholm Syndrome is, but if you were to describe it offhand, Leah, what would you say? Not to put you on the spot.
No, I was
going to
say, like, what if I completely have it wrong?
You were like, it is when the color purple matches with...
It's when you go to Stockholm.
And you pick up a virus that is called a syndrome.
So it basically is when a person maybe gets, like, kidnapped or whatever, and then starts sympathizing with or, like, liking or admiring or in some way connecting with their captors.
Exactly.
I think we talked about this in, I don't remember the number of the episode, but her name?
Could it have been episode 83?
What was that one?
About Patty Hearst.
Patty Hearst. Yeah.
We did talk about that. I was just about to mention that.
Yeah.
It's essentially a psychological term that describes how some victims will actually end up empathizing or bonding with their captors or in non-hostage situations, they're abusers. So, for example, someone experiencing Stockholm Syndrome may actually protect or defend their abuser or even align with some of their values or goals of that person. A good real life example, you just brought this up, it was our episode 83. We discussed Patty Hearst, in which we talked about her capture by the Symbionese Liberation Army, and you and I spent the entire 45 minute episode trying to decide if she had indeed been brainwashed and was exhibiting a classic case of Stockholm Syndrome, or if she perhaps was a traitor and a liar and had been involved from the onset.
Or maybe both. I don't know.
Maybe a combination of the two.
Yeah.
Let's start it again. Let's start the 45-minute debate all over again.
Okay.
While the Patty Hearst case is a great example of potential Stockholm Syndrome, the greatest example is, of course, the case in which the psychological condition derives its name, the 1973 Stockholm bank robbery.
I'm actually really excited because I don't know. I know that it's based on this historical whatever moment, but like, I don't know any of the details about it.
And I'm really excited because I felt like I did know a lot and I kind of have shifted my perspective of like why these people ended up kind of aligning with their captors in the first place. And maybe it isn't necessarily Stockholm Syndrome. So let's dive into it. To give a little bit of background before we begin, on August 23rd, 1973, a man named Jan Erik Olsen, a convict, attempted to rob a bank in Stockholm, Sweden. Olsen, later
also alongside a former jailmate of his, Clark Olofsson, would end up taking four of the bank employees hostage while they awaited police to comply with their very specific demands. Over the course of this hostage situation, the hostages would actually appear to take sides with their captors, with one hostage in particular, a woman named Kristen Enmark, telling authorities that she was actually afraid of the police, not her captors. When this hostage situation was finally resolved, not a single one of the hostages testified against Olsen or Olofsson in the following criminal trial. Rather, they actually assisted in raising funds for their legal defense. This case became sensationalized as it would be the first crime in Sweden to appear on television. In fact, at its height of viewership, this live event had captured 73% of its audience. This case was particularly startling as Sweden had never seen anything like this before. Sweden was low on crime. It's known for being a peaceful country. I mean, this is not too long after, well, I guess it kind of is, but I think of World War II and how they were a neutral country throughout that conflict. They're known for being a peaceful country. Enmark herself said, quote, "I believed I was seeing something that could only happen in America," unquote. And yeah, I'm just going to leave that one there for all of us Americans to settle with. This hostage situation would last for 6 days before the captors eventually surrendered. Now, before we dive into this topic and into this episode, I do think it's important to note that not all psychologists agree that Stockholm Syndrome is a real psychological condition. In fact, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders doesn't consider it a condition or diagnosis at all. Rather, the proper terminology provided by the American Psychiatric Association is that the concept of Stockholm Syndrome is a response. Of course, you and I are not psychologists or psychiatrists here, but perhaps by the end of this episode, we will have come to some of our own conclusions.
Yeah, as you know, we tend to give you our opinions, whether you want them or not.
But hopefully you're here because you do. But before we can discuss this week's topic, we have to, of course, discuss this drink.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History,
the podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
All right, so we have to give a shout out to this week's cocktail sponsor, Sophie Volker.
Oh yes, she no longer works there, but she was the, I'm going to say, recruiter for how we got on the Australian ABC radio show, and she made my baby's clothes.
No, she didn't.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. You told me. Yeah.
She lives in Australia, and she's fabulous.
She has like a small business, right?
Yes. She makes beautiful baby clothes, and she sent them to me from Australia. Beautiful, handmade, custom little overall things for my girls.
Oh, how cute.
I know. It's so sweet.
Well, shout out to you, Sophie.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Sophie. Before we even thank you for sponsoring the cocktail, thank you for all the other things you've done for us.
Yeah, you've done a lot for us. So thank you for that. She left us a sweet message. She said, yay, you're back. Love this podcast so much. Aww. So that warms our heart.
Definitely. Thank you.
Today's cocktail is the Stockholm 75.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't sure if you came up with it or not.
So it's very similar to a French 75, which I do actually think we had at some point.
Some
which
reason.
Is like champagne and something else. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember. But so this, the Stockholm 75 contains a shot of vodka, about 4 ounces of champagne. I just topped our glasses. A shot of lemon juice, and then sugar to rim the glass, and then garnish with a twisted orange peel. I did it mandarin peel because that's all I have.
I love it. I would have never known.
Yeah.
I love
it. It's a simple drink, but I think it'll... I mean, it's essentially you're drinking champagne, spiked champagne.
It looks really good and refreshing. I'm excited. Cheers. Let me get another sip before I can give you an honest opinion. Lemony champagne with crunches of sugar. I really like it. It's very refreshing. Let me think. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's like an 8. It's very refreshing. I love champagne. It always makes me feel fancy. You don't like champagne?
Oh, no, I love champagne. Oh, okay. No,
your face made it look like maybe you didn't.
No, I was just going to say, like, I'm probably going to give it a 6.
Okay. I really love it. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
This is delicious.
This is an easy one.
It was really easy for me because I didn't do anything. I bought the vodka and that was it.
That's not true. You rimmed the glass beautifully, might I add. The best sugar rim I have ever seen this girl do.
It is true. But that would be because I spilled like half the bag of sugar on the counter. So there was plenty of sugar to work with. But yeah, it actually is pretty beautiful. Okay. So we're going to take things way back to 1973.
So far back.
Well, see, when I was writing this episode, I was saying that sarcastically, but my millennial heart is cringing to realize that 1973 actually was way back. It wasn't 30 years ago.
Right. It wasn't 30 years ago. It was like 50, 60 years ago. Vomit. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
A man in his early 30s named Jan Erik Olsen entered Credit Banken. I don't know how to say that with an accent, but that is how you pronounce
it. I'm not even going to try. Yeah.
a bank in Stockholm, Sweden. In all of my research, I kept seeing conflicting accounts as to whether Olsen was a convict on parole, a prisoner released on furlough, or a prison escapee.
Interesting.
An important distinction, one would think.
I feel like very important.
Certainly. But one I just really was not able to get a definitive answer on.
Okay.
The majority of my sources said that he was a convict on parole, but I thought it worth mentioning that more than one of my sources did contain differing information.
Okay.
When he entered the bank, he was wearing makeup, sunglasses, and a wig.
What kind of makeup? Blue eyeliner?
I was going to say, like, CoverGirl. I was trying to think of...
Maybe it's Maybelline.
Maybe. Maybe it was Maybelline, perhaps. As he goes into the bank, reports state that he shouted, quote, "The party starts," unquote. And he began firing off rounds from his submachine gun, injuring one security officer's hand in the process. He would take hostage 4 bank employees, 3 of which were women, 1 was a man, and would demand of authorities 3 million Swedish crowns, roughly $710,000 then, but thanks inflation, the equivalent of about $4 million today.
Oh.
Yeah. He also demanded a car, guns, and protective gear. Not only did he demand an astronomical amount of money and a vehicle with which I assume he intended to escape, he also demanded that his friend and former jailmate, Clark Olofsson, actually be released from prison in order to assist him in this heist and hostage takeover. Mm-hmm. Insane. The Swedish police would never agree to that, but they did. Much to my surprise in doing this research, police agreed and allowed for his buddy, who was currently serving time in prison. So he's also a criminal that was apparently rather skillful with armed robberies, to be released from prison in order to join his friend.
What?
What? The authorities also delivered on the request for a car. However, given that the criminals were stuck inside the bank, there was no way for them to reach it.
Yeah. Were they going to just like transport the Volkswagen into the bank? Or?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Correct. Yes. Along with the prison buddies inside the bank, held as hostages were 23-year-old Kristen Enmark, 21-year-old Elizabeth Aldgren, 31-year-old Birgitta Lundblad.
I love that name.
I do too. I was just going to say that. What's...
Sound of Music.
Yes.
Birgitta.
And 24-year-old Sven Safstrom. Olsen and Olofsson. So that's going to be a lot.
I know.
Olsen and Olofsson.
I know. I was thinking that from the beginning.
And I didn't even think it until I had to say it just now. They barricaded the group in a vault inside the bank, leaving the door open just ajar, which police would use in the following days to slip food and water through. I don't think that's too outrageous because there are hostages in there that they're trying to keep alive, innocent civilians.
Yeah.
But yes, the hostage takers also end up with food and water by essence of, you know.
Yeah, no. I it wasn't the food. It was more that they went so far as to lock themselves in a vault.
I see.
Feels a little odd.
I see what you're saying.
Odd.
Yes, I think it was, as we'll get into, to provide an additional layer of security between themselves and the police.
Yeah, but then you're also, there's no exits.
Right. This was not...
Like, you're betting on the fact that they're going to let you out alive.
This was not thought through very thoroughly. Okay. Rather early on, reports stated that you could see an unusual bond forming between the hostages and their captors.
Okay.
So, for example, when Lundblad attempted to call her husband on the phone, a request that was made and allowed by the captors, so that already is kind of like, okay, she became distraught when she was unable to reach him. In response to this, Olsen gently touched her cheek and told her, quote, "Try again, don't give up," unquote.
Which Gentle.
Another example of kindness Olsen extended to his hostages was draping a jacket over the shoulders of Aldgren when she began to shiver. Yet another example, albeit a twisted one, of Olsen showing kindness to his hostages was when he chose not to shoot one of them in the leg. I'll explain.
Okay,
I'll explain
great.
Further.
Yeah, I'd love a little bit more of an explanation
as to why this was gentle and kind.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, after a day and a half of failed negotiations with authorities, Olsen decided he would shoot one of the hostages to show the police that he was serious. Olsen promised Safstrom that he would only graze his leg with a bullet, which, you know, fellow hostage Enmark was encouraging Safstrom to just take the bullet. She was saying, like, hey, it's only
just
in your leg. It's only in your leg.
Yeah.
Only the thing, the vehicle with which you use to move your body every day.
Correct.
But Olsen ended up not following through. Safstrom's response to this whole situation was gratitude.
Gratitude.
He said, quote, "All that comes back to me is how kind I thought he was for saying that it was just my leg he would shoot," unquote.
Why? That's odd.
It's odd. And finally, another example of kindness shown by Olsen to his victims was when they witnessed him slicing up the last of some pears that authorities had given them, noticeably giving himself the smallest pieces.
Most of these things are very small things that, like, shouldn't shift.
But are the standards so low?
Right. Were these people, maybe these people all happen to be people that had very, very low standards for human kindness.
Very low standards for your perpetrator's kindness.
Right.
If you're getting food, I don't know that I would have the assumption that my perpetrator would share food with me.
No.
So then when you notice that they are taking significantly smaller portions of the food, it's like, oh, that was kind of a nice thing from this person that has been holding me hostage.
Threatening to shoot me. Yeah.
Essentially, I am starving and terrified and have been unable to contact my family. That was really nice. That big pear slice I got, yum.
<That's> exactly. It's just...
I mean, we're joking around and it is odd. Like, we should talk about how odd it is. But I also acknowledge that we are not in that situation.
Right.
When you are under distress, your perception can be manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, the police commissioner was able to enter the vault. This was, you know, in an attempt to just observe the hostages and ensure their safety. And he quickly noted that while the hostages appeared to be hostile toward him, they were more, according to history.com, quote, "relaxed and jovial with the gunmen," unquote.
I mean, there is a part of me that's like, regardless of the situation, of the like hostage aspect of the situation, being in a small room with people, anybody for 6 days, like you get to know each other.
You do. I can say in like a non-distress scenario, every time I was just pointing at you because every time we go to Disneyland or whatever together,
yeah.
I feel like you and I get, not that we're not already close, but like so in sync that we have like the exact same
creepy,
thoughts.
Actually.
It's creepy.
Yeah.
And I've had the experience all growing up going to summer camps when you're like, you are my best friend and I'm going to talk to you every day. And then you end up writing like one letter a year for 1 year and that's it. But you really do bond with people the more time you spend with them.
For sure. Yeah.
Olsen chose not to show how serious he was via enacting violence on his hostages, but rather by calling up some big names, aka the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palm. On this phone call, he told Palm that he would kill the hostages if his demands were not met. Palm refused, so the following day, Enmark, one of the hostages, actually got on the phone with Palm herself and pleaded with him to have Olsen's demands fulfilled. The audio from Enmark's call would shake the world, leading credence to the theory that she and perhaps some of the other hostages as well were forming a bond or even an alliance with their captors.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark told Palm that she would go along with Olsen if authorities would just allow him to take the money and leave in the requested car. She said, quote, "I fully trust Clark and the robber. I am not desperate. They haven't done a thing to us. On the contrary, they have been very nice. But you know, Olaf, what I am scared of is the police and that they will attack and cause us to die."
I didn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Palm would disregard her request, leaving the hostages to feel as though their lives were less important to authorities than outsmarting the criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, like I just mentioned, this message from Enmark gave the public the perception that she had aligned with the captors.
Sure.
But in hindsight, researchers have now theorized that perhaps it wasn't so much a demonstration of how much she trusted her captors as it was a demonstration of just how much distrust she had for the police. And that's when we were talking in the intro about how much we knew about this case beforehand. This is the element I did not know, and I learned so much in my research, is just how much distrust there was in the authorities. Mm-hmm. And I think that that entirely motivated their decision to align with their captors.
Yeah.
Hey, hashtag history friends. My name is Caitlin, and I'm a licensed tour guide in Washington, D.C. People who take my tours all ask the same question. Why didn't I learn about this on my 8th grade trip to D.C.? Well, that's because I highlight women's history and women's culture all across the nation's capital. And, well, women have kind of been erased from history and public spaces. So my company, A Tour of Her Own, explores all the sites where women are remembered, like Lady Bird Johnson Park and Hidden Figures Way. Last year, we were voted best tour for out-of-towners. And I know that you are probably a history nerd, so I want to invite you to explore DC with me and join our next virtual tour. And since I love this podcast so, so much, I'm giving you a sweet deal. Use promo code #history for 25% off all of our virtual programs in 2024. Can't wait to see you on tour.
I think you and I can already list off a handful of dumb decisions we've seen the authorities make in this case, right?
For sure.
The primary one being, yeah, let's go ahead and release a convict so he can go help out a convict friend of his conduct a bank heist and hostage situation. Yes.
That was not the smartest move.
Certainly not. But there would be many more mistakes made by police that would cause the hostages concern about their own safety.
Yeah.
There were instances in which the police would intentionally aggravate the captors, and also instances in which they would point their guns at the captors with the hostages directly in the line of fire. Police also showed incompetence when they misidentified Olson initially. So you'll remember, because we talked about, maybe it's Maybelline, how Olson had gone into the bank in a disguise.
Right.
Well, apparently that threw authorities off so much that they misidentified Olson as a prison escapee named Kai Hansen. Police went so far as to get Hansen's kid brother to call Olson in an attempt to get him to give up the heist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Could you imagine like getting that call as Olson being like, who the f*** are you?
Well, and I imagine it the other way around as the brother, like, hey, bro, that's not
my brother. Nope.
You're literally not my brother. And when it was realized that the police had gotten the wrong guy, the brother publicly referred to them as idiots.
Yeah.
It was widespread that the police were making mistake after mistake.
I could absolutely see as captors, like seeing them fumble time and time again. Maybe I'm not actually so empathetic with the captors, but maybe I'm just like, just give them what they want so we can get the out of here. You're being
yes.
idiots.
And I think you already see that. And the further we get into the episode, you'll see it more, that it really feels more like that. That it's not so much that they were aligning with them and their values as it was the alternative is not people I trust. So whatever I have to do for survival, I'm going to do.
Yeah.
On the third day of the hostage situation, the police decided to sneak into the bank and close the vault door. You will recall from earlier that the small gap that was left by keeping the door open ajar is what the police were using to deliver food and water to the hostages.
Yeah.
With the door closed, authorities hoped to persuade the convicts to give up. To persuade them further, they also removed all phone access from inside the vault to anyone other than the police.
Okay.
When this proved unsuccessful in luring the criminals out, police began to drill holes into the vault.
Why?
You'll see.
Okay.
On one of these occasions, the police snagged a picture of inside the vault. It's a picture that would be distributed at large.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm going to show it to you now, Leah. And okay. I will also be posting to our social media, but I'm going to put like a trigger warning ahead of it on our social media in case any of our listeners do not want to see the picture. It's not bad, but it can be a bit jarring once you see what's going on.
Okay.
So with that lead up, are you ready to see the picture?
I'm very ready. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, like they're very clearly tired. They're in a very small mm-hmm. room mm-hmm. together. Are they tied?
No. That's why I was saying it's not horrible until you see what's yeah. going on. Do you see what is hanging from the yeah. ceiling above them?
It's like ropes or something. That's right.
Yeah. It's nooses to hang them from.
Oh.
Yes. This is.
That's one of Olufsen the captors.
Here.
Olufsen. Okay. Posing for the picture. Smiling. Cheesing.
So, yes. If you choose to look at the picture on our social media, it's not initially...
No, there's nothing like... There's nothing gory. There's nothing gruesome or anything. There's just nooses.
There are nooses.
Yeah.
And Olson wanted this image to be circulated widely, to go viral, if you will. He wanted to send a message to the authorities that if they attempted with more violent methods to extract the criminals from the vault, mm-hmm. he would be forced to hang the hostages. And when I say more violent methods, it was rumored that the police intended to use the holes that they had drilled into the vault as gateways to release tear gas inside.
Oh, okay.
For the victims, this furthered their distrust in the police and in turn heightened their trust in their captors.
Yeah.
And Mark stated in more recent years, quote, "I didn't think he was going to hang us," unquote.
Yeah. There's a big part of me that wonders if he's like saying to the police, hey, we're going to hang them. But then as soon as that's done, he's like, I'm not going to hang you guys.
100%.
Like, yeah, like, it's fine.
Something I didn't put into my research, so I do not have all the accurate details. But in my research, I learned that Olson, I mean, part of why he was in prison was for a robbery. And it was a robbery of an elderly couple in their home.
Uh-huh.
And in the course of the robbery, the older gentleman collapsed and his wife asked Olson, please, before you continue to steal our money and stuff, can you go get his heart medication?
And he did.
And he did.
Yeah.
And so I think that people that are like that, that projects.
Oh, for
sure. So I think exactly what you just said, people that are in the vault with him, even though they don't want to be there and they're probably generally scared or nervous and on edge, still have a general sense of like, are you actually going to follow through with this?
Yeah.
Probably not.
I mean, and he clearly had chickened out once before with the whole gunshot to the leg thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if chicken out is the right term, but like he clearly made his demeanor and his actual intents obvious to them by not doing that.
Definitely. So for Enmark, she never thought that the captors were going to hang them. She nor the other hostages were sure what exactly the police would do.
Yeah. Like, where, how far are they going to take this? Yeah.
Their worst fears came true when on day 6 of the hostage situation, the police began pouring tear gas through the 7 holes they had drilled into the vault. The hostages could be heard coughing and wheezing as the gas reached their lungs. It wasn't long before voices could be heard from inside the vault saying, quote, "We give up," unquote, and the hostage takers officially surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
Authorities demanded that the hostages leave the vault first. The hostages refused. And Mark yelled out, quote, "No, Jan and Clark go first. We'll gun them down if we do," quote. Okay, so that already feels odd.
Yeah.
Get ready for some additional really odd behavior from the hostages.
Yeah.
As they were being released from the vault, the hostages began hugging and shaking hands with their captors.
It's sharing a bunk with people at camp for 6 days straight.
It's hanging out at Disneyland.
Yeah.
Okay, I shouldn't have made that comparison. but it is the summer camp analogy of you become close with these people. You learn their intentions.
Yeah. I mean, similarly, you're washing dishes together, you know, you're camping in the mud. You know what I mean? Not the greatest conditions
Definitely.
At camp, but you're sharing these very deep connections with people.
The camp that I went to had a rock that people would spit on. It was called Spit Rock. And you would be dared to lick it.
You would lick it.
Yeah. Not the best living conditions, I will say.
Beautiful.
I once made money off of licking that rock.
You did it?
Yeah. Still here.
I wouldn't have done
that. I didn't go for a wet spot. You could see like wet spots.
Okay.
I got a dry spot.
I mean, dried spit. Yeah.
Certainly. Anyway, so they're hugging, they're shaking hands with the captors.
Yeah.
The hostages even begged authorities not to harm them. And Enmark in particular was heard saying to Olofsson, quote, "Clark, I will see you again," unquote.
Wow.
Eventually, Olson and Olofsson were led away in handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've already agreed this is very odd, isn't it?
Yeah, like I can see having empathy for them, and I can see like even being like, you know what, you seem like a decent guy. I even like you, but I don't know that I would go so far as to like hug them.
Yes,
for keeping me in a vault for 6 days.
Yes.
I don't think I would do that.
I also think it's fair to acknowledge that we have fortunately never been in this position. We don't know how we would respond.
Oh my gosh, yes. No. Yeah, I'm saying in my completely coherent right mind right now.
It's odd.
Not put in that situation.
Yes. Yeah. So let's now dive more into Stockholm Syndrome as a concept. We've already discussed the actual story and the background. Now let's talk about it as a psychological response.
Okay.
As we discussed in the intro of this episode, Stockholm Syndrome, also referred to in a law enforcement setting as terror bonding, is the concept or condition to explain this odd bond that can develop between hostages and their captors. The hostages can appear to be taking the sides of their captors,
even going so far as to protect and defend them.
Nils Bejerö, a Swedish psychiatrist, was there with police during this bank robbery, advising them from a criminology perspective. Bejerö would coin the phrase Normalstoy syndrome, named after the town square where this incident took place. That name was Normalstoy, since you've heard me struggle to say Normalstoy syndrome multiple times. You can tell it is a bit difficult to pronounce, though, and eventually this phenomenon instead took on the name of the city where the incident had occurred, Stockholm.
Most people can pronounce that.
Yes. It didn't start as Stockholm, but it derived that name due to the difficulty with which I have been pronouncing the correct name.
Yeah.
According to Bejerö's daughter, the doctor had no idea that this term, Stockholm syndrome, would one day be used in such a global sense. And I think, you know, evidence of that are pulled open with this episode. The fact that you were able to just rattle off, this is what Stockholm syndrome means. Everybody knows that. The concept of Stockholm syndrome can be confusing and difficult to understand why victims may bond in such a way with their captors. It was confusing and difficult for even the victims of this very incident to understand. The day after they had been freed, Aldgren was quoted as saying, quote, "Is there something wrong with me? Why don't I hate them?" Unquote.
Yeah. Well, I think the fact that they're questioning that makes it like clear that something did happen.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like something psychological did happen there. Even if it's not like a syndrome or whatever, like a reaction happened.
Yes. We'll talk about this a touch later, but I think that that quote in particular makes me think of abusive relationships and not just romantic relationships. It could be a parent and child. Like, to my parent, why don't I hate you even though you abuse me? It's this weird response, survival response.
Yeah.
Even the captors themselves didn't fully understand the phenomenon they were experiencing. Olsen was later quoted as saying, quote, "It was the hostages' fault. They did everything I told them to. If they hadn't, I might not be here now. Why didn't any of them attack me? They made it hard to kill. They made us go on living together day after day like goats in that filth." Oh God, I didn't even think about that. Talk about trauma bonding.
Trauma bonding? Oh my God, yeah.
Even like our bond over which toilets we were using in Disneyland, we're bonded. And I didn't have to watch.
Once you have to openly talk about poop.
That's a whole nother level. It opens the door to the next level.
Yeah.
There was nothing to do but get to know each other, unquote. So I think that's interesting too, that even the hostage takers were like, what is going on? I don't understand why I am bonding with these people that I intend harm upon.
Yeah.
This alliance that formed between captors and the captive extended into the legal trial that followed this incident.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single one of the victims would testify against Olsen or Olofsson, and some of the hostages even went to visit them while they were in jail.
They must have really had a true bond.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really? I know we were joking about it, but like, they must have had a very deep connection.
And I know we're kind of joking when we drop parallels between this and summer camp, but I see really similar parallels. You bond with those people.
In this like isolation,
And those are people that sometimes there were people from summer camp that if they lived in another city over a couple months later, I would try to see them or we would write letters.
Yeah.
Because you have this shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
Olofsson would eventually be acquitted of the crime, claiming that he had never intended to assist Olsen in the robbery or the capture, but rather was just there to ensure the hostages were kept safe.
And to be fair, he did not ask to be let out of jail.
He did not. Olsen, on the other hand, was sentenced to 10 years in prison. When he was released, he got engaged to one of the many, many women that had been writing to him while behind bars.
Oh.
And I want to point something out really quickly. There's a lot of misinformation out there that he ended up
marrying a hostage.
Exactly.
That's what I thought you were going to say. I was going to be like, oh my gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yes.
But if that had happened.
In all of my research, that came up multiple times, that there's this major... a lot of misinformation about that a lot of people believe that that's not the case, but there were hundreds of women that wrote to him during his time behind bars, both because they thought he was hot and two, because they saw him as this gentle figure.
Yeah. I mean, he clearly kind of was.
He would eventually move to Thailand with his wife and son for a period of time before returning to Sweden. And in 2009, he published an autobiography titled Stockholm Syndrome.
That's an apt naming.
Correct. Both men would continue to commit further crimes following the Stockholm bank robbery.
Oh.
The phenomenon of Stockholm syndrome has been used to explain a number of other hostage situations. One of the most popular ones is, of course, that of Patty Hearst. Like we both mentioned early on in this episode, we covered the kidnapping of Patty Hearst in our episode 83. And I recall that you and I went back and forth time and time again debating whether Hearst was indeed a victim of Stockholm syndrome or if she had been colluding with her captors all along.
Yeah, just circular conversation. Yeah. The difference in this situation is like, it just feels like the captors would never have chosen to be there in a box for 6 days shitting in the corner. You know what I mean? Like, whereas, like, we don't know if Patty Hearst, like, right? That was the question.
Yes.
Was, like, was she choosing to be there?
And the question was, yeah, was she choosing to be there? And had she been involved
prior.
From the beginning?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the big...
big difference. Stockholm syndrome has also been used to explain away the actions of a number of the women involved in the Nexium cult, namely actress Allison Mack. Nexium was revealed in more recent years to be an incredibly dangerous sex cult, with Mack as one of the highest level members of the organization. I don't know if you want to say anything more about Nexium or gross Keith Raniere.
No, I just tried to go back and watch Smallville after like the whole Nexium stuff came out, and I was like, nah, I couldn't.
Yeah. It's too bad.
I loved that show.
I loved that show. Do you want to know something kind of embarrassing? It came out on Tuesday nights. Those were the new episodes.
The fact that you remember that? Wow.
Well, I'll tell you why. This is why. Because I have a vivid memory. I was at my old dance studio, and the end of class was the hardest part of class because, you know, like the first bit you do bar, center of the floor.
You couldn't focus.
Oh, no. I had hyper focus because the last like 30 minutes of class was hardcore, like push-ups, crunchies. And I had a difficult instructor who I still have a vivid memory. 400 crunchies we had to do.
Wow, that's a lot.
400 of them. You could take a break at like 100 and stretch out your abs or whatever, but then you had to start again. And the whole time I was doing them, I was thinking, Tom Wellington. When I get home, I'm going to watch Smallville and see Tom Wellington.
Got you through.
He got me through.
Wow.
Also, Mac did not.
No.
He did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So speaking of her, she was responsible for not only pleasing the founder, Keith Raniere, sexually, but she was also responsible for recruiting other women to do so as well.
Yeah. And among other things.
Among so many other things.
Yeah.
As part of this cult, the women were also forced to deprive themselves of things like food and sleep, and they were also threatened with blackmail if they did not follow through with Raniere's demands.
Yeah.
So is it possible that Mac's loyalty and allegiance to Raniere was a result of Stockholm syndrome?
I don't know. I mean,
brainwashed?
Brainwashed, possibly. I mean, I don't know. I feel like that's slightly different in that she's not being held captive. She's not, it doesn't seem to be against her will.
But to what degree?
I know.
Or is she just a really, really bad person?
Yes.
That much, yes. But yeah, I would, when you're deprived of, I know as a new mom, which fortunately my babies are now 5 months and they're sleeping better, but there was like a 6 week period where we were getting very little sleep.
Yeah.
And I was an almost different person from the lack of sleep. I almost feel like the hardest part of being a new mom is the sleep deprivation.
Oh, yeah.
It changes you.
Chemically. Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
And so to what extent, to what degree of the food deprivation, the sleep deprivation, did that change her?
Yeah.
Did that manipulate her perception? And does that fall on the scale of Stockholm syndrome to some degree?
Yeah.
Despite her vehement denials, Elizabeth Smart has also been alleged to have experienced Stockholm syndrome to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
In 2002, Smart, who was 14 years old at the time, was kidnapped from her home by Brian David Mitchell and his wife, Juan Farsi. For the following 9 months, Mitchell raped her repeatedly. To explain why she never attempted to run, some psychologists have alleged it's because she had Stockholm syndrome. But in Smart's words, quote, "I never had Stockholm syndrome. Just because I physically stopped resisting doesn't mean I hated it any less.
Yeah.
I wasn't sympathetic towards them. I despised them."
Yeah.
Unquote.
Yeah. There's a difference between doing something because you think for like it's for your own safety and like sympathizing or empathizing or falling in love with or whatever the people that are have captured you.
Definitely. Smart has repeatedly said that everything she did was for her survival.
Yeah.
In later years, this is what Enmark has said of her experience as well. She has said, quote, "I think it is a way of blaming the victims. All the things I did was instinct of survival. I wanted to survive. I don't think it's so odd. What would you do?" Unquote.
Well, again, the difference, the part that I find weird is not, yeah, in that moment, in that survival mode, I get it. It's like the fact that afterwards these people like raised funds.
Yeah.
That's the part that I find, I'm like, something psychological did happen there.
100%. Yeah. And I think that, and I'm just about to dive into that now, and we talked about it briefly earlier, that it really sucks to refer to these events as everyday examples. Mm-hmm. But I do think we see everyday examples of these same survival responses from victims of abusive relationships, mm-hmm. whether the abuse is coming from a partner or a parent. We have a tendency to protect and defend in those instances, oftentimes simply as a coping mechanism and a survival instinct. But again, it's a psychological thing of like, you can rationally know I'm being abused by this person.
Yeah.
But I still love them. I can't explain it. And so months later, when they're behind bars for the abuse that they inflicted upon me, I'm still writing letters and I'm still visiting them. It's something that is so difficult to explain.
Mm-hmm.
When we look back on the Stockholm case, so much of the victim's loyalty to their captors was not necessarily because they trusted their captors, but rather it was a response to just how much they distrusted the police.
Mm-hmm.
If either one of those parties was going to harm them, the Stockholm victims were certain it would be the police, for it was Olsen or Olsen. And so they did what they had to do and relied upon whom they had to rely upon in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I'm so glad that we did a deep dive into this situation, because I feel like with more context, we, or at least I, in my research, really got a different story and perspective.
Yeah.
Perhaps the origin story of Stockholm Syndrome isn't necessarily how much the hostages trusted their captors, but rather just how much they distrusted those that were supposed to be protecting them, aka police.
Mm.
And I think that same line of thinking can be applied to many situations that get the undeserved label of Stockholm Syndrome. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag History.
We will share the picture that we discuss on the episode to our Instagram, and all sources used to put together this episode can be found on our website at hashtaghistory-pod.com.
Subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use, share about us with your family and friends, and then give us a rate and review.
And then be sure to check us out on Instagram at hashtag history_podcast.
And come join us over on Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can help support our books and booze supply. You also get access to some behind the scenes content, an automatic 15% off all merchandise, and we mail you cards and stickers.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
That's it.
Thank you.
Bye.